From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And grim numbers today from the Commerce Department show U.S. gross domestic product fell nearly 5% in the first quarter, the largest dip since the Great Recession. And it's only going to get worse. Tanya, the majority of this data came before the coronavirus outbreak. Just a few weeks in March was able to kneecap the economy.
Yes, and the next report will include April and May. Meanwhile, the virus has rattled every part of the economy and cost millions of Americans their job. Since the crisis began, at least 26 million workers have filed for unemployment, and many can't get to the benefits they're entitled to. Michelle Evermore is a senior policy analyst specializing in unemployment insurance at the National Employment Law Project. And Michelle, we've been hearing about unprecedented backups, people not able to file for weeks. Do you have any idea how many people who have filed and are still waiting for checks?
It's not entirely clear because we don't have up-to-date claims process data. We have some estimates, and it looks like the majority of people have not gotten an unemployment insurance benefit yet.
And we're talking about throughout the country.
Throughout the United States. So one thing most people don't realize is that unemployment insurance administrative funding is based on last year's unemployment rate. So that means that states are processing a record high number of claims with a record low level of funding.
I want to focus on one state to really get at this point. Earlier this month, you wrote that Florida had only processed 5% of the claims submitted since the beginning of the pandemic. What's the situation there now?
It looks like they're starting to process claims. On Friday, they took their Connect system down and started processing claims. Their processing numbers have gone up. But now I'm seeing reports that denials are very, very high because people who are eligible for pandemic unemployment assistance are being told that they're just not eligible for unemployment benefits.
And those types of people are what types of workers?
So these are any workers who don't qualify for regular unemployment insurance, independent contractors, self-employed folks, or people who qualify for pandemic unemployment assistance for reasons they would not qualify for regular unemployment insurance.
What's their rationale for denying those folks?
So what it looks like happened is that people are getting their denial for regular unemployment insurance, and they haven't been run through for consideration for pandemic unemployment assistance.
Where else are people struggling to get benefits? And are there states that have handled this well and might serve as a model for the rest of the country?
I'm seeing bad processing numbers in a lot of the states that you'd expect to be slow: Indiana, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. There are states that have been doing a good job at processing claims. Rhode Island is doing a good job. You know, Washington State was one of the first states to get hit, so they started processing claims sooner than others. California is another good example of a leading state that took in a lot of claims right away. So just by virtue of being ahead of the curve, they've processed a lot of their claims.
I see. Is there anything about their systems that some of these other places could take away? I know it's a complicated process.
Yes. So Washington State, for example, is one of only 16 states that's fully modernized their IT systems. Most states are still running primarily on 1970s COBOL mainframes. And no. Washington State not only modernized their system, but then when they saw that there were inefficiencies, they went through a remodernization process.
I want to ask you about something else that we've been hearing a lot about. Unemployment temporarily may pay more right now than in normal times because of additional money added from the federal government. And that actually means that some workers may be making more on unemployment than they would if they were working. Some Republican politicians have really been speaking out about this. What are your thoughts on this? Is this a flaw in the system?
It's not a flaw at all. Congress decided that 100% income replacement was necessary for the time being to keep people at home. But having states reprogram their computers to recalculate how benefits are paid would be impossible. So they added $600, which is basically the difference between the average weekly benefit in unemployment insurance and the average weekly wage. They had to be a little bit broad here in order to get to that 100% for the average worker, which means some workers will be getting a little bit more. But that in no way discourages people from taking work. The other thing is, it's not legal to quit a job to take unemployment insurance. And workers who are on unemployment insurance are expected to take suitable work that's offered. or lose their benefit. So this is a really difficult system to game. It's historically that way because it's intended to keep people attached to the workforce and give them stability in that process.
And right now, sounds like there are millions of Americans who can't even get into the system in the first place.
Right. I can't imagine opting to stand in line for the uncertainty of possibly getting a benefit if I have a job offer in hand.
That's senior policy analyst Michelle Evermore of the National Employment Law Project. Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's consider North Korea now. It hasn't reported a single case of COVID-19, despite sharing a border with its ally China, where the outbreak started. And coincidence, Kim Jong-un, the country's leader, hasn't been seen for about 3 weeks, about since the pandemic started. And he missed the annual ceremony to mark his grandfather's birth. That's North Korea's founder. That's Kim Il-sung. And that was considered a big deal. So how is Kim's health? Let's bring in Jim Walsh, here now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, what do you think is going on?
Well, it's hard to tell. Now, normally, if someone if the president of the United States disappeared for 2 weeks, we would all be in a tizzy. Mm. I think it is a possible indicator of something gone wrong, but it's not a smoking gun. Why do I say that? Because this particular leader and his two predecessors, his father and his grandfather, also disappeared for a period that raised questions and suspicions. And so I think it's a piece of data. You put it together with the other data you have, but it is not a smoking gun.
Do you think there's a chance that he is quarantining because of the COVID-19 outbreak? Of course, people wonder if he's sick. There are reports that he had heart surgery recently. He's very heavy, some buttons straining on his clothing. But do you think there's a
possibility?
Do you think there's a possibility he's just saying, I'm getting out of here for a bit?
Could be, but he certainly, as the head of state, he could certainly fashion conditions if he wanted to that would protect him and still allow him to be seen in public if he wanted to, right? So I'm sure he could figure out a way to do it. And so while I think the speculation can be unfortunate because it might make them a little nervous, might spook them, are we talking about whether he's dead or not? Are we going to make some sort of bold move because we think that's true, blah, blah, blah. That's why the president and the South Koreans are downplaying this. I think it's a worthwhile reminder. We're all rightly focused on COVID, but we're talking about a nuclear weapon state. And folks in my business, one of the traditional concerns is what happens when a nuclear weapon state goes through a leadership transition? What happens if infighting breaks out between the military and other organs of government that are vying for power? So on and so forth. Now, do I think that's going to happen in North Korea? No, but you take nuclear weapons, a possibly ill or incapacitated leader, without a clear line of succession, that is to say it's a monarchy without a clear line of succession, you've got what I can only imagine is their economy is cratering, and finally, you've got a mass pandemic. Now, Robin, you'll remember, you probably covered this in 2011 when they had their previous leadership change when Kim's father died. It was in December, cold North Korea. Let me tell you, it's cold on the Korean Peninsula in December. I've been there. And the requirement was that everyone turn out, hundreds of thousands, millions of people turn out in squares and do not cover their faces because the government wanted to record, the signs of authentic sorrow on the part of the population. Well, if they were to do that here, I don't think they will. But if they were to do that, that is a COVID nightmare.
Well, do we already know whether or not there's a COVID nightmare there?
That one I'm willing to bet on. The North Koreans completely deny it. Yet they admit that they have quarantining, yet they say they built a hospital in 3 days. They are, as you point out wisely, smack dab on the border with the origin of the virus. Now, when you look at maps of Chinese cases, there aren't a ton of cases along the border with North Korea, but North Korea depends on exchange. North Koreans going over to China and returning from China, Chinese going into North Korea with goods and services and returning back. Were they able to avoid it? I doubt it.
Real quick, what do you think President Trump meant? You said the president and South Korea are downplaying the speculation because they don't want North Korea to get nervous that they may make some chessboard move on this nuclear state. Mm. But what do you think the president meant when he said, "Oh, I know what happened. What's happened to Kim Jong-un?" Do you think he does?
The president says he knows everything about everything, and it's a little hard to distinguish. So, you know, I think it's impossible to say. I will say this one thing that President Trump deserves some credit here. If we were going into a possible leadership change with North Korea and our relationship was deeply hostile, aggressively hostile, that could very well shape the transition in ways that would be dangerous. Trump has a personal relationship with Kim and has done some negotiation. It's not all negative. It's not all hostile. And so I would say the Trump administration gets some credit for negotiating with North Korea, because that relationship may bear fruit now during these next several months.
Yeah. Jim Wells, here and now security analyst with MIT Security Studies Program as well. Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. Be safe.
You too. So what is the status of the tests and trials for treatments or cures for COVID-19? Our next guest says it's so chaotic it makes his heart ache, with more than 94 trials for the antimalarial drug hydroxychloroquine alone. The same goes for clinical trials around the world for other treatments, hundreds of them with a lack of coordination that's causing duplication and lost time. And then there are the trials themselves. How do you convince doctors and their very sick patients to participate when there's a 50% chance they're getting a placebo, not a lifesaver? That's a hard sell. Derek Angus chairs the Department of Critical Care Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. He's leading a trial that will test multiple drugs and therapies at once. It's part of an international effort. We're going to get to that. But Dr. Angus, Professor Derek, welcome.
Thanks very much.
And you have said it's a cacophony, not an orchestra. There's no conductor. But I can hear people outside your world saying, well, 94 trials for, you know, chloroquine, the more the merrier. So why not that thinking?
So first of all, it's not because people aren't well-meaning. People have ideas and they think, hey, I should test this idea. This disease brings about in people a huge passion to try to fix the problem. The problem is that the way clinical research works, we aren't in peacetime, if you like. We have hundreds of drugs to test. But because there wasn't one large coordinated effort, to a certain extent, it behaves almost like a marketplace where everyone is trying to lobby to have their idea heard. So, for example, investigators, drug companies are all knocking on the door of every hospital or large academic medical center saying, please do my study. My study is most important. And it instantly put the whole world into a position of trying to choose. It's like this massive cottage industry.
The Washington Post reports that the National Institutes of Health, led by Francis Collins, is recognizing this problem. He is planning a global public-private partnership, including pharmaceutical companies, academic research centers, but it's been under wraps because they're trying to get people to buy in. How hard is it to ask companies to maybe put aside potential revenues from their project to back somebody else's, countries to put aside their national pride to be the first, researchers to share what they may know? How hard is that?
So you said it really well. So first of all, I think it's fantastic that Francis Collins is doing this. We really need to try to get everyone in a room, try to overcome tribalism. Our system was built for a good reason. Federal funding agencies tend to fund national projects because they're responsible to their taxpayers. Investigators that work at universities do have some responsibility to the universities, and pharmaceutical companies are in a marketplace in competition with each other. So there are legitimate barriers to one effective large collaboration. So I think what Francis is tackling is totally the right thing to do. How it works out is going to be interesting.
I'm imagining there's another question of buy-in, because you point out that there are 2.5 million cases of COVID-19 worldwide, but fewer than 2,000 people in clinical trials. You told CNN that if even 1 in 10 had been able to participate in a trial, we might have had 100 different drugs by now. But I'm wondering if patients are not participating because In these trials, it's a 50% chance of getting the drug. Others get the placebo. And with this deadlier disease, maybe patients don't want to do it.
That's right. Clinical research has to partner with clinical care. And traditionally, a lot of clinical research designs, it almost felt like a choice. You can either take care of the patient or you can test the drug. And that's in part because some of the designs that are best for testing the drug don't feel very friendly towards taking care of the patient. And at the heart of it, no one wants to be a guinea pig. So study designs that are 50-50 chance of getting the drug, they don't feel like they're leaning in to the needs of the patient and the doctor at the bedside. When you get down to the nitty-gritty of it, people who are busy just struggling to find PPE and feeling overwhelmed and they have a patient who's sick right in front of them, they're thinking, I need to do something now to care for the patient, and don't bother me with all this research stuff.
Well, Dr. Angus, let's get to what you are doing, because it answers a little bit of that. It's a fast-track REMAP trial, it's called. It's modeled on something you did in 2009 during the H1N1 pandemic. Every patient gets something that might work, and you're testing combinations of drugs together. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're testing?
Sure. So first of all, you talked about 2009. So that's when it first dawned on us that the traditional randomized trial is really hard to get off the ground and run efficiently in a pandemic. And that led a bunch of us around the world to start thinking about trial designs that would be more flexible. And the special adaptive platform trial we most wanted to try was something called a REMAP, which is randomized, trying to test multiple options all at the same time. That's like choosing a starter, a main course, and a dessert all at the same time. And only one of each of these is usual care. And so if you have three starters, three main courses, and three desserts, that's actually 27 choices. And only one of the 27 choices does not include at least some active therapy. So what happens there is nearly everyone is getting the opportunity to try something that we think will help. The other thing we do in the design is the trial learns as it goes. And so you might start off with a 1 in 27 chance for every combination, but the combinations that are doing best get a bigger and bigger share of the pie over time.
Okay, so let me ask you something, because somebody might be hearing you and thinking, well, you know, we just heard that there are hundreds of trials around the world. Maybe he's just selling his trial. If you were to find out, it turns out there's someone in Italy who's doing the same thing, only maybe getting, you know, maybe a little bit ahead of you. Would you be willing to fold your program at Pittsburgh into theirs, or to stop yours altogether?
Yeah, so it's a great point. I totally lie in bed at night and tell myself, okay, so if I'm a team player, I should be prepared to surrender my ideas too. I have lots of opinions about which drugs I think might work best. I've ended up deciding to not even voice my opinions. But rather tried to really just think more about what's a trial design that can be as modular as possible and let as many people in as possible. The REMAP program that we put out in Pittsburgh is actually tied into an international effort that involves hundreds of investigators. And there's no question that we have to do some compromising for the joint good. And so our trial is actually enrolling in London, and we're just about to bring on some Italian sites, and we enroll across Europe and Australia and Canada, and that's totally the goal.
Well, good for you. I mean, you that you put both thoughts out there. But just, can I do a lightning round with you real quick, if you can? Are you seeing anything promising about remdesivir, which attacks parts of the cells?
So remdesivir has been studied in its own trials with Gilead, and that's consequently made it very hard for anyone to actually get access to remdesivir outside their trials. And so I'm like the rest of the world waiting to see the results of those trials. There have been some preliminary reports suggesting, for example, that severe patients in Chicago did better than they might have expected, but there's no control group there. And then there's been another study that was accidentally released that was then covered in the New York Times suggesting, oh, maybe it looks like it didn't work. I think at this point, remdesivir, we simply don't know.
Quickly again, convalescent plasma, this is drawing blood with antibodies in it from people who've fought off COVID-19 to give that blood to boost the immune system of people who are very sick.
Yes, so convalescent plasma is a very important step. It's a slightly crude way of taking advantage of the human host's own antibodies to the infection. And so there are issues about whether convalescent plasma is made in exactly the same way from place to place, but that will be one of the first highly specific interventions against COVID-19. We would then expect it to be replaced by more specific synthetic immunoglobulins that hopefully will come in the summer. And we're testing, for example, convalescent plasma in our program.
Very exciting to hear that that could be replicated, the antibodies in the blood. That's Derek Angus, chair of the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center's Department of Critical Care, running their research there into cures or treatments for COVID-19, but also asking, as many others are, for a global approach. Dr. Angus, Professor Derek, best of luck to you. We all await what you find. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And we mentioned the drug remdesivir. Well, just today, Dr. Anthony Fauci said there is good news on that front. Drug maker Gilead released data saying that patients, COVID-19 patients, recovered 4 days sooner on remdesivir than those who were not taking it. He says this proves the drug can block this virus, although another study from China was inconclusive. So have you or a loved one been part of a clinical trial? Do you think you or they benefited or felt like guinea pigs? We'd love to hear from you at hereandnow.org. And North Carolina's stay-at-home order has been extended through May 8th, including a prohibition on gatherings of more than 10 people. But while some states with COVID-19 outbreaks are only allowing immediate family members to attend funerals, North Carolina is allowing them with up to 50 mourners. Leonita Inge of WUNC visited a funeral home that served the Black community in Durham for generations.
LSD Jones and Sons funeral directors built their family business in South Central Durham 85 years ago. And you could say they know everybody, and everybody knows them.
See how people love me? They want me to stay safe. I've had so much love. Like
Nina Jones Mason appreciates all the love. A family friend just handed her a box of face masks.
Thank you. Love you. I appreciate you doing this for me.
Jones Mason is a fourth-generation funeral director at LSD Jones and Sons. During this coronavirus pandemic, her community is counting on her to stay healthy.
The stress level of trying to keep everything clean, keep everybody safe, keep my staff safe, because if anybody comes down with it, we're shut down. Can't do that.
Jones Mason recalls the dozens of African Americans who were infected with COVID-19 after attending a family funeral in March in Albany, Georgia. Epidemiologists call the event a super spreader event. More than 100 people in the rural region have since died. Jones Mason officiated a funeral in March that was larger than what she wanted it to be. It was more than 100 people at a church and even more at the reception.
We're a culture that loves to support each other and, you know, we love to feed each other, and that's not happening. That's a major difference, you know, repasts and taking people food and visiting with them. Those things aren't happening.
The latest funeral restrictions in North Carolina allow for 50 people to gather. LSD Jones and Sons only allows for 30 after measuring to keep people 6 feet apart, and there are no rides in the limousines. There were 29 people at Pearlie Ann Cameron's service on April 19th in Durham. She died of a heart attack. A list of attendees was required, and everyone had to wear a mask. Lee Afford is Cameron's brother.
We got to do the right thing. It's protecting ourselves and everyone else.
Cameron's daughter, April Wise, understands the social distancing rules, but says,
we were going to get together. Might not have been a service, but we was going to be together. It wasn't going to be big. We might have took turns, but we was going to do it.
Still, Wise is glad Nina Jones Mason was there for them to lean on again.
We are thankful for her. She's helped us bury my aunt, my grandma, now my mom.
I feel so much compassion and just empathy for them. There are some funeral homes that are not allowing people to have a service at all.
When the service for Pearlie Ann Cameron was over, family and friends who sat several feet apart inside embraced outside. There were tears, especially after an ensemble began to sing. For Here and Now, I'm Leonida Inge.
And as the number of coronavirus infections worldwide surpasses 3 million, the hunt for a vaccine grows ever more urgent. The health publication Stat has been tracking 13 potential vaccines. And for more on that, we're joined by Stat reporter Helen Branswell. Hi, Helen.
Hi, Tanya.
Let's talk through a few of these potential vaccines. The U.S.-based company Moderna Therapeutics set a drug industry record when it identified a vaccine candidate about 42 days after this novel coronavirus was sequenced earlier this year. What are they working on?
Well, first of all, they're partnered with the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, which is one of the NIH institutes. They're trying to develop a vaccine that would generate antibodies to what's called the spike protein. If you've ever seen a picture of coronaviruses, they have these little dots surrounding them that look like a tiara or something, which is why they're called corona or crown viruses. Mm. And so Moderna and many other places, frankly, are working on developing antibodies to that spike protein. The way Moderna is doing it is something called mRNA. It's a technique that effectively delivers a little bit of messenger RNA that goes into cells and then effectively turns your own cells into a little vaccine factory. This gets into cells and spurs them to generate antibodies that hopefully will protect against the virus.
We're all getting science and biology lessons through all of this. Inovio Pharmaceuticals is also trying something else. They're trying to use DNA to develop a vaccine. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so they are also using a process where you would effectively deliver a small payload into the cells, and that would provoke the cells to start generating proteins. The thing to know about both Moderna and Inovio is that while their approaches are quicker in the early phase, neither of them have yet brought a vaccine to the market, which could slow things down later on because, regulatory agencies, the speed at the front may not be matched a little bit later on. That we'll have to see how that works out.
Yeah. Let's talk through a few more drug makers who are also working on potential vaccines. A Chinese company that developed an Ebola virus vaccine says it's moving to phase 2 trials soon. Mm-hmm. What efforts are underway there?
So that's CanSino. And yes, I think they've actually either started or are starting their phase 2 this week. Their vaccine is made by fusing a protein from the SARS-2 coronavirus onto another kind of a virus called an adenovirus, which is a kind of coal virus that can infect people. So the idea here is that this live virus vaccine can effectively present to somebody's immune system the main protein that causes COVID-19. So this vaccine could not trigger the infection of COVID-19, but it could alert the immune system that this is an invader you want to be on the lookout for and get it to start generating antibodies. It's an increasingly common way of making vaccines.
Yeah. I want to talk about testing on humans. So of the 13 vaccine trials you're tracking, only 3 are being tested on people so far. What are some of the other trials that are currently underway?
So people will be hearing the terms clinical and preclinical a lot as we go forward.
Yep.
Preclinical work lays the groundwork for taking it into the clinic, which means starting to administer it to people. So there are several now that are in phase one. And as you mentioned, one is in phase two human trials, and the others are doing the work that will hopefully lead to clinical trials in the near future.
We were hearing earlier this week about the Serum Institute of India that's going to produce, I think, 40 million units of an experimental coronavirus vaccine developed by researchers at Oxford University. Is that a promising effort?
Yeah, frankly, at the moment, that one's the one to watch. Mm. They're moving really, really quickly, and they've started a phase one and a phase two together, which is quite unusual. That will really compress the timeline for development of this vaccine. In fact, they are now saying that there may be enough data by September that this vaccine could start to be used under emergency use in the fall in limited ways. An interesting project and one to watch.
Yeah, which actually makes me wonder, once there is a vaccine, is it going to be just for vulnerable groups like healthcare workers at first? Do you have any sense of how a vaccine will actually be administered once it's developed?
I think those plans are still being worked out. I mean, one of the things I find concerning is when people are talking about timelines for vaccine, they aren't actually stipulating that publicly, but it is very true that in the early days, the amount of vaccine that will be available will be limited. And so it will be prioritized. Presumably, healthcare workers would be top of the list. Another thing that has to be considered is that there are real concerns that countries may nationalize production. So if it turns out that a vaccine that's made in country X is effective, that country may effectively say, we will export once our needs are met. I was interested to see recently that Bill Gates wrote in a blog that while these vaccines should be distributed equally, you know, right off the bat, that probably isn't going to happen.
Hmm. I mean, you've really laid out for us the complexities of why it might be really a complex or difficult proposition to come up with a vaccine quickly for everyone. I mean, a lot of folks are thinking, well, there's a vaccine every year for the flu. Why is it taking so long? But is it possible there won't ever be an effective vaccine against COVID-19? I mean, we have seen reports of people getting the disease, recovering, and then testing positive again. I mean, could that indicate that they're being reinfected? And would that mean anything for the viability of a vaccine?
A couple of things there. I mean, yes, there have been some reports out of China and out of South Korea that have raised the question about whether or not people can be reinfected really quickly. The thinking is that probably isn't what's happening there, that rather than having recovered and been reinfected, that they probably had never stopped shedding virus, but that the testing was a bit faulty. So, you know, you got a couple of negative tests. They thought you were clear, but you were still emitting virus, and they tested you a third time, and somebody had a better testing technique and picked that up. But it is true that there's a lot of concern about how long any immune response to these viruses would last. But there are human coronaviruses that are related to this one, and they don't typically generate like long-term immunity. In some cases, people can be reinfected, you know, within about 10 months. So that, again, is unclear. I mean, whether this is a vaccine that would have to be given repeatedly in the course of a lifetime, like flu vaccine, or is something that you could get and maybe only have to renew on a 5 or 10 year cycle, sort of like a tetanus vaccine. Not clear at the moment. I guess there's always a possibility they won't be able to develop a vaccine, but at this point, it's way too soon to go down that road.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what? What I'm really hearing from you is that it really takes time. I mean, there are just so many things that we're learning in real time.
Right. That is true. And typically vaccines take, you know, 8 to 10 years to develop. I don't think that's going to be the case in the current situation because of the acute need and because of the realization that some of this work can be done in sort of overlapping ways. You will remember a few years ago in 2014, there was that very bad Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Merck took a vaccine that had never been given to people before. And within 10 months, that vaccine went from the first in human trial to completion of a phase 3 trial that showed that it worked. That was a record, obviously, for a vaccine. And it showed that kind of work can be done in a more compressed fashion if you need it to be, and if you have both the commitment to speed things up and the money to do it. And I think that we'll see that kind of an approach here.
That's Helen Branswell. She's an infectious disease and global health reporter for STAT. Thank you so much, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll link you to STAT's vaccine tracker at hereandnow.org.
We want to check in now with another small business owner. Janice Jucker of Three Brothers Bakery in Houston, Texas, is paying her employees, even though her revenue has dropped because customers can now only take out or order online. The Paycheck Protection Program helps her pay them, but she also stockpiled cash and began to improvise new forms of revenue as soon as she heard about COVID-19. Improvising is something she's used to doing. Janice, why is that?
So my husband and I, we call ourselves the king and queen of disasters because we've been through 4 floods, a fire and a hurricane, and now a pandemic. We've had to come up with some creative ways to make up for lost sales. So we came up with a program, Buy a Pie, Employ a Village. You know, if we sell 50,000 pies, think about all of our bakery ecosystem that's touched. That's the nut grower, the box maker, the pie tin maker, the flour provider, sugar, you know, all of these things are other companies, and other companies mean other people are being employed. So nothing says love better than a pecan pie from Three Brothers Bakery. I'll just put that plug in.
But, you know, so this notion of going online, what do you think about the fact that your governor has announced that he's going to move forward with plans to reopen the state by May 1st in phases? Do you feel it's safe yet?
I'm in a different position than, let's say, a bar owner. We do have some revenue coming in. I just don't want to go through this again. So if it meant another month, I would go for that. I also think if they reopen everything, I think people are going to do what they feel safe doing. You know, if you, I get manicures every other week, okay.
Really? You still do?
And no, I'm paying her, but I'm not getting them.
Ah.
You know, I won't go back and get my manicure for, you know, at least another month.
I just want to say good for you on 2 counts for supporting someone, your manicurist, and then also for sounding like you're making the decision, I'm just not going to take that risk. Look, I know you did apply for some loans and had some success.
So after Harvey, we were with a very big bank. And we had tried to get a loan and couldn't, and we moved banks after Harvey. And that was the best thing. They're a smaller bank. So if you're a small business, go with a smaller bank because you're going to have that personal relationship. And then when you apply for these loans, and I can't remember exactly what I had to provide for the PPP, but it was some of this plus some extra, some new stuff. But if you do the SBA disaster loan, for example, the EIDL loan, you're going to need 2 years of tax returns. You're going to need 3 months of current financials, plus your personal. So for us, that was 10 different tax returns times 3 years worth. So I'd have 30 tax returns, certificates of formation, your incorporation papers, some board meeting minutes. I mean, it's a lot of paperwork. And I have a suitcase that is filled with paperwork from all these disasters and is not a carry-on piece of luggage. Okay, it's filled. So I'm going to add this one to that.
Wow. Do you see the landscape changing? Like, people aren't going to want to get food out of a glass cabinet in a bakery. Or, you know, how do you see this long-term affecting you?
I see that a lot of people, we were already moving to that delivery model where more people wanted their food delivered, whether it's groceries or restaurant food or bakery food. But last week, our son and daughter-in-law live way the heck out. And they said, well, why don't we take orders for our neighborhood? And then we'll come in, pick it up, and then we'll drop it off. And that's been amazing. It was amazing how that worked. And so then we added another neighborhood for this week. And so I think that's going to be a new business model, because the third-party delivery apps, they take so much money that it's not worth doing. So that's something that is different. And we would not have done that if this hadn't happened. And another thing, I have been so touched by the outpouring. People have started, they just send us money. And they say, please bake some bread or whatever and give it to someone in need, whether that's fire, police, first responders, people working in the hospital, the homeless. And we've created funds on our website that you can donate to. And then what we did for these organizations and people that are feeding those in need, we created wholesale accounts for them. So if you donate, just use $500. I'm not saying donate $500, but I'm saying for every $500, they get an extra $75 in baked goods. And it's amazing.
Boy, you are speaking like a true entrepreneur. When the whatever hits the fan, there's something about a pony or something, you know, how can we see the pony in all of this?
Well, what I say, Robin, also, you are allowed one pity party and that is it. And then you got to get to work if you want your business to survive. Nothing is the same after a disaster. This one has been absolutely the hardest economically for us. Absolutely.
Well, Janice Jecker, their co-owner with her husband of Three Brothers Bakery in Houston, Texas, we wish you all the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here Now.